Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Often during a crisis, a leader emerges to bring his or her fellow citizens together. A good leader can provide a sense of a way through a difficult time. A good leader can inspire greatness from everyday people. A good leader leads. Currently, we've seen people emerge from both parties with a kind of command that provides some sort of faith that someone's on the ball. For example, Governor Mike DeWine of Ohio and our own Governor Cuomo. And then there are others, like the governor who didn't issue a stay-at-home order until yesterday. I'm looking at you, Florida man. One of history's great leaders is the subject of a new book that looks at a very specific moment of Winston Churchill's time in power. It's called The Splendid and the Vile, a saga of Churchill, family, and defiance during the Blitz. It's written by Eric Larson, a best-selling author of nonfiction narratives that include The Devil in White City and Dead Wake. And Eric Larson joins me by phone. It is a pleasure to have you, Eric.
Yeah, thank you. It's a pleasure to be there from my home studio.
There you go. Will you tell us what the significance of the title is, The Splendid and the Vile?
Sure. The Splendid and the Vile is derived from a diary entry by one of the key characters in the book, John Colville, who was one of Winston Churchill's private secretaries, this sort of an overworked bunch of young men. The diary entry, he made this entry on an evening when there was a particularly intense raid in London, and he watched this from the window of a bedroom, as one does, right? He watched this from the window of a bedroom and was so struck by the beauty of the night, the black sky, the anti-aircraft shells bursting, bombs, flames, and so forth. And it moved him to write that it was this incredible juxtaposition of natural splendor and human vileness. And right then I knew that was going to be my headline, my title.
So there are so many books about Churchill. You've written about him in the past in your own book, Dead Weight. But, you know, there's an interesting way that you write about Churchill in this book. It's through a different lens. You write in your notes, "I set out to hunt for the stories that often get left out of the massive biographies of Churchill, either because there's not time to tell them or because they seem too frivolous. But it's in their frivolity Churchill often revealed himself, the little moments that endeared him to his staff despite the extreme demands he placed on all." What are a few examples of these frivolous details that you feel really reveal Churchill and his leadership?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, one of the things that surprised me as I got into this was honestly how much fun Churchill could be. I mean, you know, don't get me wrong. He took this very, very seriously, but he was also a guy who was able to put things in a context. So he liked, for example, he loved to sing. He liked to sing. One of his favorite song, apparently, was Run, Rabbit, Run, Run, Run. He loved songs from The Wizard of Oz. He liked to dance now and then at 10 Downing Street or out at the Prime Ministerial Home Checkers to strains of Gilbert and Sullivan. And there was one particular scene that actually I just adored, which was when at this house in the country at Checkers, he had had a big dinner party, and afterwards, he turns on the gramophone, puts on some military music. He is at this point wearing his favorite siren suit, which is a one-piece pull-on jumpsuit, if you will, of his own design, meant to be pulled on in an instant. It's pale blue. Over this, he is wearing a gold silk dragon dressing gown. He gets his Mannlicher rifle, his big game rifle. He attaches a bayonet to it and proceeds to very seriously do bayonet drills in the Great Hall at Checkers at this country estate. As his guests stand around the edges, the perimeter of this scene, just laughing hysterically, because, you know, here's the prime minister looking like this, as I pointed out in the book. I mean, he looks a lot like an Easter egg gone to war, you know, so.
Well, this brings me to our next question, and it may tie into his behavior. He liked to drink.
Well, he did like to drink, but he was never drunk. This is one of the fascinating things. You know, there was an inclination by many who didn't understand Churchill at the time, including President Roosevelt, to be concerned that Churchill was in fact a drunk, but he wasn't. His staff, this John Colville, for example, who wrote this lovely diary, he makes the point in a separate memoir that he never saw Churchill drunk. He never saw him lose his faculties to alcohol. And Churchill himself once says to his wife Clementine, and it is pronounced Clementine. He once says to his wife that I've taken a lot more out of alcohol than alcohol has taken out of me. But it is the case that he drank all day. I mean, he started the day with a tumbler of whiskey and water, very small amount of whiskey, a lot of water. Lunch, there would be champagne, wine, perhaps brandy afterwards. Dinner, there would also be the same kind of regimen, and afterwards brandy and so forth. But here's a guy who nonetheless was able to work well into the night, too late as far as his staff is concerned. He would work until about 2, maybe even 3 o'clock in the morning. So there was never any evidence that I came across that indicated that he was ever impaired by his consumption of alcohol.
What you said about his work ethic brings me to the last part of that statement when you describe the extreme demands he placed on all. What kind of demands were you talking about?
Well, for one thing, just simply on the level of hours, and you know, his private secretaries who were very important to the running of 10 Downing Street. They were almost like assistant prime ministers. This is cadre of young, very very bright, very very hardworking young men, and they would work. You know, they were essentially on duty whenever Churchill was on duty. So that meant, you know, from 8:30 in the morning until 2 or 3 o'clock at night. The demands on them were to you know, help get his speeches lined up, deal with correspondence with ministers, anything that he needed, they were on call to do. To top it off, Churchill, as much fun as he was, as I said, Churchill was also at the same time he was deeply inconsiderate. He was rude. He was often abrupt. But that was more than counterbalanced by this sort of lovable side to him. He never held a grudge. He was able to compartmentalize things. If he was really angry about something, you would know it. He would never apologize to you, but he would also indicate in some other way that all was forgiven and let's get back to how things were.
My guest is Eric Larson. He is the author of The Splendid and the Vile, a saga of Churchill, family, and defiance during the Blitz. There's so much detail in this book, down to the way you described the way he was dressed on a certain night at a certain party. What was your research process like? How did you get access to letters and all those kinds of things?
Well, first of all, the challenge in this case, and you kind of alluded to it earlier, you know, obviously a lot has been written about Winston Churchill, and I don't even think I appreciated how much when I got into this. You know, I was not drawn to this subject because of an inherent desire to write about Churchill. What drew me was this idea of, like, how on earth did Churchill and his family and so forth, you know, how did they ever endure the German air campaign? You know, the Blitz, 57 consecutive nights of bombing, followed by 6 more months of bombings at intervals, and so it was that drew me to Churchill. So I decided early on that I was going to read enough about Churchill to understand the basic Churchillian landscape, if you will. I was not going to even attempt to read everything because that's a fool's errand. That would take a decade. And it would take a decade probably, honestly, just to read all the things that Churchill himself has written. So I decided early on that I was going to make a strategic decision, and that was that I was going to get that sense of the landscape and then dive right into the archives using my particular lens, my particular question, which I actually nobody had asked before, honestly, in a full-length book. You know, how on earth did they do it? And so when you do that, when you look at history through a fresh lens and you dive into the archives, you will find things that are new, at least in terms of scholarship. Whether other scholars saw them before or not, I don't know. But to me, they come. This is brand new stuff. Or you look at old things in a new way. Now, one of the things that is brand new in this book and that I absolutely loved was I was very lucky. Early in the process, I asked for permission to look at and use the diary of Churchill's youngest daughter, youngest surviving child, Mary Churchill, who at the time, in 1940, when Churchill became prime minister, she was 17 years old. But she kept this really terrific daily diary that is a wonderful document for because she was an astute observer. She was very, very smart, very, very articulate, but also because she was 17 and she wanted to have some fun. And it's just this terrific counterpoint to all the death and mayhem. She shows that life went on. her parents tried to, for a while, farm her out to the country estate Checkers because it, for her own safety, something she chafed at, as she talks about in her diary. But when she was there, you know, local RAF bases were a terrific source of fun. There'd be dances, there'd be, as she refers to several times in the diary, there'd be evening snogging sessions in the hayloft. So it was a really nice counterpoint to really nice insight, actually, into how life was actually lived during that period.
You mentioned parents. Let's discuss Clementine for a bit. She apparently, she was very strong and apparently could just destroy someone verbally, you describe. How was she an asset to him?
Well, she first of all, she resolved during this period that she was going to support him, and that was it. You know, this was going to be what she was going to do. So that was terrific. One particular way that she proved to be a real asset that I loved, and again, this is part of what happens when you just dive into the archives, kind of blind, if you will. I mean, it's the case for me that I never know what I'm going to find until I find it. And so I came across, which to my knowledge has not been excerpted in any other book either. I came across this extensive series of personal reports that she had sent to her husband, to Winston Churchill, after she had toured various public shelters in London. These shelters were notorious for having terrible conditions. And so she, if you can imagine this stately, you know, this august stately woman venturing into these places and chronicling, you know, the ponds of urine, the waste, the stench, and so forth. It was just to me a really lovely image. But also she was doing a real social good in highlighting to her husband this direct line of communication that these public shelters were not working, and they were going to harm him politically if things weren't changed. And sure enough, he made sure that things changed.
My guest is Eric Larson. The name of his book is The Splendid and the Vile, A Saga of Churchill, Family, and Defiance During the Blitz. Okay, we talked about Churchill, we talked about family. Let's talk about the Blitz now. I'm going to set the scene. It's May 1940. Hitler has occupied Poland since September of 1939. Then Britain declares war on Germany. Now France and the Low Countries, Netherlands, Luxembourg, Belgium, have been invaded by Germany and are being crushed. England and the world, they're holding their breath. They're seeing what will happen in France, what will happen. Britain's government undergoes a sea change. How did Churchill become prime minister in all of this?
Very nice summary, by the way. Yeah, so May 10, 1940, Churchill becomes prime minister after a revolt against Chamberlain had unfolded in the House of Commons. The feeling was that Chamberlain was not up to waging war. There was too much grudge, he had previously been at the forefront of the appeasement movement, and the feeling was that this is not what we needed at that time. A couple of names were put forth, but it was Churchill who won out, much to the dismay of many in Whitehall, which is of course the seat of government in London. Even the king, whose ultimate job it was to appoint the prime minister at that point, even he did not like the idea of Churchill being prime minister because he was too erratic, too energetic, in too many different directions. So anyway, so Churchill becomes prime minister on May 10, 1940, on the day that Adolf Hitler, that his forces invade Luxembourg and Belgium and then begin their amazing surge into France. Now, anybody else, you know, having this happen on the first day of the job might be daunted, but not Churchill. For one thing, being made prime minister was the high point of his life. Truly, this was what he had sought throughout his career, and the fact that it happened when the war suddenly became a very hot war thrilled him, because now suddenly he was in charge. He was in charge of this, the whole shebang, and even made himself defense minister. So this was a powerful thing for him.
You describe this as the year when he really became the Churchill that we think about,
yes,
and that he showed the world courage and leadership. How so?
Well, so in this year, and again, it's May 10, 1940 to May 10, 1941, which, by the way, it was not my intention starting out to say, okay, I'm just going to write about the first year of Churchill's prime ministry. It's rather that the German air campaign happened to fit neatly into that compartment, that 1 year, because essentially it came to an end on May 10, 1941. I mean, there were subsequent raids throughout the war, but never was the campaign as vast and concerted as during that period of Churchill's first year as prime minister. What Churchill confronted during that period, I'm probably going a little bit off your question here, but you know, if I may, what Churchill confronted during that period was this incredible confluence of rising pressure and aggression, because you know, no sooner did Hitler invade the Low Countries, he began his march through France, then came Dunkirk, France fell, the fall of France was something that no strategist in Britain had ever anticipated or seen as possible.
It was
It was so quick, but also it changed utterly strategic assumptions. It meant that the Luftwaffe would now be able to have air bases on the French coast, literally minutes from Britain. And so now suddenly, what also became very much a real possibility was the idea that Germany would invade England, across the Channel, something they could not do unless they possessed air superiority. So, and that's the landscape that Churchill faced, and that's where he, as a leader, really came to the forefront. I mean, you know, we know him now because of during that period his speeches. We know him because of his presence after they were bombing raids. He would visit bombed out areas looking tough and smoking that cigar and periodically holding his hat above his head on his walking stick so people would know he was there. And that's how he became implanted, or let's say imprinted, on the world's imagination.
How involved was he in the details of getting the country on war footing?
Churchill was very involved in the details, a lot more involved, frankly, than the ministers around him would have preferred. And he got involved in these things in part because of some of the advisors that he appointed. Churchill, another mark of Churchill's leadership was that he appointed key advisors, his close circle, his so-called secret circle. He appointed key advisors who he knew would tell him the truth. He knew that they would cause some conflict. In the case of one advisor, he didn't know how much conflict, but these advisors kept him deeply advised on the details of what was happening, especially his personal scientific advisor, Frederick Lindemann, who was universally despised throughout Whitehall, but was very good at isolating problems, at taking a contrary viewpoint, which was very, very valuable. But it also allowed Churchill then to direct his minutes, or his memoranda, they were called minutes, directly to the ministers involved, much to their consternation, but about really incredibly detailed things. So yeah, he was on it.
I can remember last time I was in London, I went to the war rooms, the Churchill war rooms.
Yes.
You know, and there was this odd kind of gallows humor in the war rooms. There were signs that would say, like, windy when it was a bombing raid.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
How did he use humor? How did he use language and words during this time?
Well, first, one quick note about the Churchill War Rooms. I think it's kind of a fascinating little point, is that Churchill himself only spent three nights in the war rooms. He preferred to spend his time in the so-called Downing Street Annex, which was sort of a fortified apartment above the war rooms. But you know, humor. Churchill did have a really terrific sense of humor, and he deployed it. He deployed it as often and as well as he could. He was also, you know, the thing that really struck me, though, was how incredibly well-read he was, his grasp of history and so forth, and how this came through as well. And one thing popped into my mind as you were mentioning that about humor. It's not exactly humor, but one of the most striking moments to me was when there was a big air raid, and Churchill had been having a dinner party at the I think it was at the Annex, and he goes up to watch this air raid unfold. You know, this is the Prime Minister of Britain, and here's this air raid, but he goes up to watch it unfold, which is more than what he did. And of course, he brings his guests up to watch as well. And while he's up there in the midst of this raid, he recites lines from a poem by Tennyson called Locksley Hall, which was a poem that many considered to have sort of foretold the advent of aerial warfare. So if you can imagine this guy, I mean, here's the Prime Minister of Britain who is not cowering in a shelter. He goes up on a rooftop, watches this raid unfold, and there he is reciting poetry. That is a rare leader.
I'm curious about his relationship with the United States during this point. Joseph Kennedy, and I'm describing him, and please correct me if I'm wrong, he's sort of America's top official dealing with the UK. He and Churchill did not get along.
No, Joseph Kennedy was America's ambassador to Britain, and he and Churchill did not get along because Joseph Kennedy was a real pessimist. He didn't like Churchill. He didn't have any confidence that Britain could actually prevail. He was also considered to be something of a coward, which was not something that anybody, you know, in Churchill's hierarchy would have liked to have known, or would have liked. So Joseph Kennedy was actually kind of, after the initial period, was kind of immaterial to what happened from then, because Churchill began to focus entirely on a courtship of President Roosevelt in every conceivable way that he could. As he himself put it later, he said he had pursued Roosevelt's attentions with as much ardor as any lover had ever targeted the object of his affection. And it began actually within days of Churchill becoming prime minister. There is a moment immediately afterwards where Churchill is shaving. His son Randolph is with him in his rooms, and Randolph is being somewhat skeptical about Britain's fortunes, likely ability to win the war, and he felt certainly Britain could fight Germany to a stalemate. But how do you win? And he asked his father that, and his father was adamant. He throws his razor into the sink and he goes, "I shall drag America in." And from that moment on, he made every possible effort he could, as subtly as he could. I mean, talk about being a consummate human fly fisherman. I mean, he was really trying to draw the president into the war.
My last question for you is, Winston Churchill wrote, "Power in a national crisis when a man believes he knows what order should be given is a blessing." We are in a time of a global crisis.
Yes.
Is there a world leader on the stage you think shares any of his qualities?
You know, I'd have to go out and try to take a look at all the world leaders and compare. But you know what I think? I think, honestly, it's not a world leader, but I think Mario Cuomo, not Mario Cuomo, sorry.
Andrew.
I think Andrew Cuomo.
I've done the same thing all week.
I'm thinking back to Freedom. You're lucky I didn't say Ed Koch, you know what I mean? No, but I think Cuomo is looking pretty good, you know, and people, friends of mine, have actually been, like, tweeting to me or emailing me saying, boy, you know, Cuomo is my Churchill, so he's not a world leader. But hey, maybe one day.
My guest has been Eric Larson. The name of the book is The Splendid and the Vile, A Saga of Churchill Family and Defiance During the Blitz. Eric, thank you for spending some time with us today.
Thank you.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.